Chapter 14. Non-food applications of fermentation. People have harnessed the transformative power of microorganisms for many purposes other than producing foods and beverages for our own consumption. This chapter surveys non-food applications of fermentation, defined broadly to encompass both aerobic and anaerobic microbial processes, which fall into a few broad, often overlapping categories: agriculture, land and water reclamation, bioremediation, waste stream management, fiber and building arts, energy production, and medicine, drugs, and body care. Agriculture. Fermentation has many applications in agriculture, as fundamental as building soil fertility, saving seeds, preserving forage for livestock, and controlling pests. Compost. In composting, bacteria and fungi transform a mix of kitchen and garden scraps, leaves, wood, manure, straw, grass, really any organic matter, into humus that renews the fertility of the earth itself. There are many different methods of composting. Even without any method, piles of scraps of organic materials will break down. But depending upon your method, that pile can smell foul or fine, generate significant heat or none, break down faster or slower, and favor aerobic organisms or anaerobes. The sources of both microbial inoculation and nutrients are the compost feedstocks. In general, the more varied the feedstocks, the better. People talk about compost feedstocks in terms of balancing carbon and nitrogen. Carbon is the primary element of which all living cells are composed. Nitrogen is also essential, but the carbon-to-nitrogen ratio varies in different types of organic substances. Wood tends to have relatively little nitrogen compared with green leafy matter or manure. It takes a mixture of higher nitrogen feedstocks with lower nitrogen feedstocks to create conditions for diverse and rapid microbial growth. Food scraps tend to be relatively rich in nitrogen, which is why it's best to mix them with other drier, lower nitrogen materials such as sawdust, wood chips, straw, or even paper. The USDA organic regulations define compost as a process in which the starting materials together constitute an initial C-to-N ratio of between 25:1 and 40:1. Commercial operations, meticulous individuals, and certified organic farms calculate how much of each feedstock will bring the average C-to-N ratios into that range. Many charts of the C-to-N ratios of different materials can be found online. In a small backyard composting operation, there is really no reason to get too fixated on C-to-N ratios. Just layer a variety of green and brown organic materials. In my home practice, I use a pretty passive, effortless composting method. I just mix kitchen scraps with straw, wood chips, sawdust, and/or leaves, along with occasional bark, animal manure, or other extras. I start a new pile every so often and turn the old one. Over time, a year or more, it breaks down, worms come, and it becomes light and beautiful humus. This process is slow and easy and suits me fine. But over at my friend Billy's farm, Little Short Mountain Farm, I've been helping him develop and implement strategies for improving fertility on many acres of pastures and fields. To restore the fertility of this land, which was farmed for years with chemicals, we're making compost and brewing tea from it in a much more methodical way, according to principles I learned from microbiologist Dr. Elaine Ingham. For building soil fertility, Dr. Ingham, along with many others, recommends composting methods that encourage aerobic microbial growth, which technically makes composting not a fermentation process at all, according to the definition of fermentation as anaerobic metabolism. Dr. Ingham explains that nitrogen and other essential nutrients are most available to plants under aerobic soil conditions, which makes sense since the best soils have a loamy structure that allows for the diffusion of air through the topsoil. She also points out that aerobic bacteria and fungi stick to everything like glue, binding soil together and giving it an ultrastructure that helps to hold water and resist runoff and erosion. Beyond these advantages of aerobic organisms, Dr. Ingham argues that certain byproducts of anaerobic fermentation organisms can be toxic to plants, including not only our beloved alcohol, which in enough concentration can be quite toxic to us as well, but also formaldehyde, volatile acids, and phenols. Aerobic compost has a mild, earthy aroma. Anaerobic compost can, but doesn't have to, smell like a fetid swamp. An anaerobic compost pile, at least a cubic yard in size, moist like a sponge but not waterlogged, will inevitably produce considerable heat. This is generally regarded as beneficial because sustained heat above 131 degrees Fahrenheit or 55 degrees Celsius kills weed seeds, pathogenic bacteria, and pests in the composting materials and makes the process go quickly. The heat is generated by frenetic metabolic activity by microbes given ideal conditions for growth. The only problem is that if the heat in the center becomes excessive, above about 158 degrees Fahrenheit or 70 degrees Celsius, then there in the center, farthest from the free flow of oxygen, oxidative, anaerobic, metabolism will no longer be able to be sustained, and the center of the pile will go anaerobic. A heat-generating aerobic compost pile is a miraculous thing to behold. The heat is a product of an alchemical mixing of the elements and fills me with awe. I've even heard stories of people cooking food by burying it in the compost or using the heat from a compost pile to heat a greenhouse. But a pile that is steaming must be monitored closely, and when the temperature in the center rises above 150 degrees Fahrenheit or 66 degrees Celsius, you have to make time to turn the pile. This releases accumulating heat in the center, aerates the pile, and remixes the elements for a more even distribution of materials and microbial activity. At my friend's farm, we use a tractor to turn the huge piles. We bought a 4-foot or 1.3-meter thermometer to monitor the temperature at the center of the pile, and each time the heat spikes, we turn the pile. With the tractor front loader, it takes about half an hour. With a shovel or pitchfork, it would take most of a day. After a few weeks, with 4 or 5 turns, the activity mellows and we can leave the compost to mature a few months. The compost thus produced is gorgeous, rich humus, and microscopic inspection confirms that it is a hotbed of biodiversity. We take some of the compost, place it in a mesh bag that looks like a giant tea bag, hang it in a water tank with a powerful air pump attached, add kelp powder, humic acid, and a bit of molasses, and blow a huge amount of air into the mix for 24 hours to brew it into aerobic compost tea. This tea enables us to spray beneficial microbes around the fields much farther and much more easily than we can spread compost. On a big farm with lots of organic materials and machinery and people to process them, an exacting process like this is not a big deal. But turning a big pile by hand, even once, is an ambitious project. Turning every few days as temperatures repeatedly spike is impossible for most busy people with backyard gardens. So as a practical matter, most people use more casual, slower, less labor-intensive composting methods. Some people, like me, just pile materials as they accumulate, turn the pile once in a while, and let time slowly decompose them. Some people use cleverly designed devices for turning. Some people use vermiculture, worms, to rapidly and efficiently transform kitchen waste, and some feed scraps directly to chickens, converting residuals to manure with hardly any work. And some people take an approach similar to food fermentation techniques, practical for microsale, indoor application, using a starter culture. Ishig Matsukawa, a composting activist who is teaching people this apartment-friendly technique in New York City, uses a vocabulary I can relate to for this, calling it pickling food waste. Shig uses an inoculant called Efficient Microorganisms, EM, developed in Japan and used worldwide, which is a community of organisms that includes lactic acid bacteria, yeasts, and phototrophic bacteria. The direct utilization of the microbes gives us control of the exact species of microorganisms we know will help us with our process, as well as having enough of them, quorum sensing, to do the job, explained Shig. This is in contrast to creating the conditions and adding the ingredients to attract and or bring out the desired microbes, as in the composting methods described earlier. Using many of the same organisms that are commonly used in food fermentations and others, nutrients are broken down into forms more available to plants, acidity prevents pathogens, and waste is preserved without noxious odors, so it can be left sealed in an airtight container for many months. The resulting odors range from vinegary to alcohol. Beer-like, says Shig. Shig's process is actually in 3 steps. A preliminary process uses a liquid starter culture, EM-1, to ferment a dry, flaky medium, such as bran from wheat, rice, or oats, or sawdust, or finely shredded autumn leaves. That is fermented in an airtight container for about 2 weeks, then dried and stored for ongoing use as a starter. As food wastes are generated, they are placed in an airtight container and sprinkled with starter. When a container is filled, it is sealed and left to ferment at ambient temperatures about 2 weeks. After fermentation, the fermented food wastes can remain in the sealed fermentation containers for as long as necessary without noxious odor. As convenient, they are buried in earth, even in a pot indoors, to further cure before applying to plants. I was curious about the apparent contradiction between Elaine Ingham's ideas about composting, that it must be aerobic, and the EM fermentation method. Shig reflected on the question and made several excellent points. First of all, he said, not all aerobic bacteria are beneficial, and not all anaerobic bacteria are non-beneficial. He also cited a compost study done comparing piles with and without EM-1 added. The EM pile had significantly higher counts of aerobic microorganisms than the control. That trial showed that the application of EM-1 microbes in the soil encouraged the growth of other good microbes, including heterotrophs, pseudomonads, actinomycetes, and filamentous fungi such as mycorrhizae, none of which are in the EM-1. Bacteria are mysterious shapeshifters. The known microbes in the starter are not the same ones that end up in the soil. The genetically fluid bacteria adapt. What seems to be happening, Shig speculates, is that the dominant microbes in EM-1 are influencing other microbes in the environment, and in combination with the added organic matter, these other beneficial organisms multiply more than usual, and multiply in diversity as well. As with any ferments, any gardening technique, and almost anything in life, there is no single best method. Whatever method you find works best for you. I agree with Shig, who says the most important evidence is the plants themselves. How to make your own fermented bran for pickling food waste. E. Shig Matsukawa, recycledfoodwaste.org. Use any kind of organic material, wheat bran, rice bran, sawdust, shredded fall leaves, chipped yard waste, etc. Material has to be dry and in granular form. We use wheat bran because it is easy to use and relatively inexpensive. For 2.5 pounds or 1 kilogram wheat bran, unprocessed, use 1 fluid ounce or 30 milliliters blackstrap molasses, 1 fluid ounce or 30 milliliters EM-1 microbial inoculant, about 20 ounces or 600 milliliters water. The liquid ratio is 1 to 1 to 20, that is, 1 part molasses, 1 part EM-1 to 20 parts water. Mix the liquids in a bowl until the molasses has fully dissolved. Place the wheat bran, which should be very dry and flaky, in a mixing bin. Slowly add the liquid mixture to the wheat bran until it's about 30% moist. By hand, it should form into a ball but break apart when touched. Mix the liquid into the wheat bran thoroughly, no dry spots and no too wet spots. After thoroughly mixing, put into an airtight container. Press down to squeeze out air. Put a plastic bag or sheet on top of it. Close lid tight. Let it sit at room temperature out of direct sunlight. White mold is good if it appears. After 2 weeks, air dry by spreading it out thinly or sun dry it. When dry, crunchy feel to it, keep in a container or Ziploc away from moisture, keeps for over 1 year, and it's ready to use. To make fermented food waste, FFW, add a handful of fermented bran to an empty container. Sprinkle fermented bran every time you add food waste. The ideal ratio is 1 to 33. Keep container closed and airtight. White mold is good if it appears. When container is full, let it sit for 2 weeks or longer at room temperature in an airtight container. Keep out of direct sunlight. For burying, if in a trench, bury with 6 to 12 inches of soil on top. Can plant seeds or seedlings after 2 weeks. If in a pit, at least 1 foot away from existing plants and 3 feet away from trees. Bury 1 to 2 feet deep and cover with at least 6 inches of soil on top. Can plant after 2 weeks, or let it be the nutrients for surrounding plants. In pots or planters, you can sandwich FFW between soil in a pot or planter. First, add pebbles, small rocks, and or sand to the bottom of the pot or planter, about 1 inch. Then add about 1 to 2 inches, 3 to 5 centimeters, of soil, or 1/4 of the pot slash planter. Add 2 to 3 inches, 5 to 8 centimeters, of FFW, or 1/3 of the pot slash planter. And fill to the top with soil. Let it sit for 2 weeks away from rain before planting. Or you can feed the fermented food waste to earthworms. Follow the general rules for a worm bin, except earthworms can go through FFW much faster, so you can feed them more often. EM is a modern-day manifestation of an ancient Japanese farming tradition called bokashi, which involved fermenting whatever organic matter was available, including rice bran, fish meal, and the dry cake left over from oil pressing. Historically, this must have begun as a spontaneous fermentation, like any other, and over time been consciously perpetuated by backslopping, adding a remnant of the previous generation into each new batch. EM has a very devoted following. I am sure it is very effective for all the varied things I've heard about people doing with it, including not only fermenting food waste, but also fermenting food, probiotic supplementation, household and industrial cleaning, inoculating septic tanks and other sewage treatment, and many other applications. But Bokashi can also be practiced as a wild fermentation. Bruno Vernier wrote to me that it can be as simple and cheap as combining whey, molasses, water, and shredded paper. Another intriguing Bokashi practice I've heard about is known as Indigenous Microorganisms, IMO. Indigenous microorganisms are beneficial members of the soil biota, including filamentous fungi, yeasts, and bacteria, collected from non-cultivated soil near the area where they will be applied, explains a Bokashi nature farming manual from the Philippines. Rice or rice bran is used as a medium on which to grow existing soil organisms. I've read about two different methods. One involves mixing soil from one or more locations with rice bran and a little water to form a ball, then suspending the ball to spontaneously ferment. The other involves actually burying a wooden box with a layer of cooked rice spread in it, in the forest for 4 days to a week. The box is loosely covered by a paper towel, then with wire mesh to protect against rodents, then a layer of plastic to keep water out, and finally, leaves. In either case, the resulting grain with mold growing on it is then used as a starter for other preparations, including Bokashi fermentation of food wastes. Much more detail on the specifics of the process is available on the internet. One final method of using fermentation as part of a strategy to build soil fertility is the biodynamic method. Biodynamic growers use an array of preparations, often referred to as preps, each of which involves fermenting an alchemical mixture of ingredients. For instance, cow horns are stuffed with fresh manure from lactating cows and buried from fall to spring. For another prep, a stag's bladder is stuffed with yarrow flowers and hung up in a tree over the summer. After its fermentation, a small amount of the prep is added to water and stirred for a full hour. Even the stirring method is prescribed. Stir in a circular motion to create a vortex, then reverse direction and create a vortex in that direction. Then reverse again, and again, and again, for a full hour. These preps are intended to harness and harmonize earthly and cosmic forces. The stirring activates the prep energetically and oxygenates it to encourage a rapid proliferation of aerobic organisms, whichever way you prefer to conceptualize it. The preps are then spread onto gardens and fields, directly sprayed on plants, or in some cases incorporated into compost piles. Fermenting urine. Another fermentation process used to improve soil fertility is the fermentation of urine. The process is simple. Collect urine and do nothing, just let it sit a few weeks. Lots of gardeners collect their own pee, and that of those around them willing to share it, to fertilize nitrogen-loving plants, collected in outdoor containers via pee jars or buckets. Pee here now, read signs at pee stations at Short Mountain for a while. Usually pee accumulates slowly and sits around, sometimes people intentionally age it. There is even a word in English for fermented urine, lant, usually used to describe aged urine used for cleaning. A microscopic investigation into the ammoniacal fermentation of urine was published as early as 1890 in the Proceedings of the American Society of Microscopists. It is an alkaline fermentation that increases pH and produces ammonia. Exactly as the acidifying fermentations destroy many pathogens, so does this alkalinizing ferment. A blogging aquaponic gardener, who uses fermented human urine as a nutrient in his system, sent urine samples to a lab for analysis, some deliberately contaminated with fecal matter. Some of each was sent to the lab fresh, and the rest was fermented until the pH rose to 9, then it was sent to the lab. Both fresh batches tested positive for fecal coliforms, both fermented batches tested negative. This convinced me that my own urine, when aged, is not going to make me sick if I use it as fertilizer for a peaponic system. Aging urine and using it as a soil fertilizing strategy has long been done in various places, making use of a nitrogen resource universally available. My friend Hector Black, 86 years old with beautiful gardens and orchards, swears by urine as a soil amendment, fresh and aged. My urine is already aged, he quips. Hector applies fresh urine to his orchard, diluted 1-to-1 with water in dry weather, full strength when the ground is saturated with water. I think some good stuff happens when you age it, says Hector. I use the aged stuff on the vegetable garden, especially nitrogen-loving plants like greens and corn, does wonders. The use of fermented urine is spreading in Uganda. We no longer waste urine in our homes, reports farmer Mary Batwawila. Each member of the family is allocated a tin every night where she/he urinates, then in the morning we pour it into a big container and ferment it for 28 days. The aged pee is then diluted with an equal quantity of water and then applied to soil. On the internet I found documentation of practices in China, India, and elsewhere. Feeding animals with fermentation. Just as humans have harnessed the power of fermentation to preserve and enhance food from periods of abundance to sustain us through seasons of scarcity, we have also used fermentation to preserve and pre-digest forage crops to feed our farm animals through forage-scarce winters. Silage is the practice of harvesting grasses, including the post-harvest stalks of corn and other grain-producing plants, and/or other green forage crops, and packing them in silos, mounds, pits, or large bales to ferment. The fermentation is primarily a lactic acid fermentation, breaking down cellulose and lowering pH. Efficient fermentation ensures a more palatable and digestible feed, states an extension publication of North Dakota State University. If forage material is very moist, it must be dried somewhat prior to ensilage. Material must also be chopped into small pieces and packed tightly in order to minimize trapped air and thus limit aerobic activity. Typically, silage is fermented spontaneously by organisms present on the plant material. Silage is an application of the principles of vegetable fermentation to cellulose-rich grasses and stalks that humans cannot digest. In some regions, the leaves and stalks of other food crops were also fermented for animal fodder. A historical investigation into vegetable pickling in Poland states, until the middle of this century, 20th, leaves of turnips, beet, cabbage, and others were fermented in huge tubs and used as winter fodder. Some people wishing to improve the health of their livestock soak grains in order to reduce phytic acid content and improve nutrient availability. Monique Trahan wrote telling me about the practice of her farmer grandfather. He fed his pigs by filling pails with oats and water and letting them sit until fizzy. Many dairy operations soak grains for livestock in whey from cheese production. Some people even make sauerkraut for their animals. My dog Kitty will sometimes eat sauerkraut, but not always. She seems to like it finely shredded rather than in bigger chunks, and she seems to prefer it only mildly sour. Rather than feeding her prime kraut to her animals, Barb Schwetz ferments the scraps for them. All the pieces of produce that don't make it into our kraut goes into a 5-gallon bucket to ferment for them. Seed saving. Certain seeds are typically fermented in the pulp that holds them prior to drying for storage. I have been watching my friend Dazzle, a master gardener in our community, save tomato seeds in this way for years. He harvests fruits at the peak of the season from the healthiest plants and scoops seeds out of the fruits in their pulp. You can eat the fleshy remains of the seeded tomatoes. Dazzle places the seeds and pulp of each variety into a glass half full of water and ferments about 3 days. Then he rinses the seeds of pulp. The better you rinse them, the less sticky they will be, he emphasizes, therefore easier to separate as they dry. Dazzle dries them on newspaper, seeds stick less than with paper towels, and stores them in a cool, dry spot until next year's planting time. In seed saving, as in everything having to do with cultivating plants, people use a variety of techniques. Michael and Jude Fanton, founders of Australia's Seed Savers Network and the authors of The Seed Savers Handbook, use a slightly different method. Allow the fruits to ripen just beyond the eating stage. Cut them open, squeeze out the jelly and seeds, putting the seeds of one variety in a jar or bowl. If you are saving the seeds of a dry, meaty tomato, such as the excellent Italian plum, you may have to add a tiny amount of water. Label the jars and leave in a warm spot for 2 to 3 days. If it is not stirred, a foam will form on top and a beneficial fermentation will take place, caused by a microbe, Geotrichum candidum, acting on the sticky gel that surrounds the seeds. Antibiotic activity deals with diseases such as bacterial spot, speck, and canker. The only danger is in leaving the fermentation process for too long, leading to premature germination. As soon as the foam forms, scoop it off the top, add water, and pour the lot through a sieve. Wash and rub until clean. The jelly around the seeds will have been washed off, and the seeds will appear somewhat hairy. Spread them on sheets of shiny paper in a single layer and dry somewhere safe out of the sun. After a few hours of drying, rub the seeds between your palms to stop them from sticking. The Fantons also recommend the same procedure for saving cucumber seeds to dissolve the jelly around the seeds and kill off any seed-borne diseases. In fact, one extension officer for the University of Illinois Extension suggests fermenting the seeds of any vegetables in which the seeds are enclosed in fleshy fruits. Seed contained in fleshy fruits should be cleaned using the wet method. Tomatoes, melons, squash, cucumber, and roses are prepared this way. Scoop the seed masses out of the fruit or lightly crush fruits. Put the seed mass and a small amount of warm water in a bucket or jar. Let the mix ferment for 2 to 4 days. Stir daily. The fermentation process kills viruses and separates the good seed from the bad seed and fruit pulp. After 2 to 4 days, the good viable seeds will sink to the bottom of the container while the pulp and bad seed float. Pour off the pulp, water, bad seed, and mold. Spread the good seed on a screen or paper towel to dry. Pest control. Another agricultural application of fermentation is in pest control. A simple old-time method is to take some specimens of pests you wish to deter, crush them into water, ferment a few days, strain, and spray on plants to protect them from those pests. One specific bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, has long been applied to crops as an insecticide against leaf-feeding caterpillars. The bacteria produce a protein that reacts with the cells lining the guts of caterpillars and other susceptible insects, causing them to stop feeding and die. Newer proprietary microbial insecticides are being developed. Spinosad comes from the fermentation of soil bacteria Saccharopolyspora spinosa, abamectin from another soil microorganism, Streptomycetes avermatillis. California vintner Lou Preston sprayed live culture whey from raw milk cheesemaking, straight from the cheese draining table, no aging, as a foliar spray on his grape vineyards. The first year he sprayed pure whey directly on the plants in a test patch and experienced no mildew on those vines. The next year he mixed the whey with an aerated compost tea and spread it on more of his vineyard, with some mildew but little, and limited to the most mildew-prone varieties. Lou also noted much better development of beneficial insect populations since they had not been disturbed by sulfur application. Sadly, the dairy that was producing the whey closed, so Lou has no large supply of whey this year. But he is fermenting grass, silage style, and plans to experiment spraying an extract of the juices. Bioremediation. In the emerging field of bioremediation, biological processes of nutrient cycling, involving bacteria and fungi, are encouraged in various ways in order to decompose contaminants and clean up contaminated soils and waters. Bioremediation has successfully cleaned up many polluted sites, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. As I was writing this book in 2010, oil was pumping at high pressure into the Gulf of Mexico from an accident at a drilling rig, the Deepwater Horizon. The news was filled with horrific images of oil-slicked environmental devastation. As repeated attempts to plug the well were failing, Scientific American declared, "Bacteria and other microbes are the only thing that will ultimately clean up the ongoing spill." In fact, at much lower concentrations, hydrocarbons, the chemical building blocks of fossil fuels, are part of the environment everywhere, and bacteria capable of digesting them are ubiquitous. No single organism can break down all the components of crude oil or refined fuels spilled into the environment, explains an American Academy of Microbiology, AAM, report. The tens of thousands of different compounds that make up oil can only be biodegraded by communities of microorganisms acting in concert. Some bacteria can degrade several hydrocarbons or a class of hydrocarbons. The combined action of the community can degrade almost all of the components. The limitation on the ability of this to happen in an oil spill is time and speed. In the years it could take for bacteria to clean up a big spill, incalculable damage can be done. Rates of oil degradation vary widely, depending on a variety of factors. First, there is a lag period, as the relatively small populations of hydrocarbon-digesting bacteria respond to the sudden abundance of nutrients. Then, generally, degradation rates slow as the oil concentration decreases, making it difficult to calculate a certain endpoint, explains the American Academy of Microbiology. They also slow as the more readily degradable components are used up, leaving behind the more recalcitrant components. Also, when oil sinks to the ocean's depths, where temperatures are much colder and oxygen is not present, metabolism slows way down. Chemical dispersants can facilitate improved bacterial access to oil floating in water by creating greater surface area. Fertilizers can be added to stimulate bacteria growth. Genetic engineers have attempted to create bacteria that can digest hydrocarbons more efficiently or faster. But microbiologist Ronald Atlas, who evaluated genetically engineered bacteria and other post-Exxon Valdez cleanup strategies, reflects, "A superbug fails because it competes with this community that is adapted to the environment." While seeding microbes into the ocean has not been effective, seeding them on land can be. Mycologist Paul Stamets has been a pioneer in mycoremediation, the use of fungi to clean up contaminated soils. Fungi are adept as molecular disassemblers, breaking down many recalcitrant, long-chained toxins into simpler, less toxic chemicals, explains Stamets. He advocates mixing fungal mycelia directly into contaminated soils, or into wood chips spread over contaminated soil, as a first step in remediation. The introduction of a single fungus, for instance, oyster mycelium, into a nearly lifeless landscape triggers a cascade of activity by other organisms. A synergy between at least four kingdoms, fungus, plant, bacterium, and animal, denatures toxins into derivatives useful to myriad species and fatal to few. Ultimately, nature fosters complex partnerships of interdependence, with fungi blazing the path to ecological recovery. Rather than introducing pure mycelia, Stamets emphasizes using acclimated spawn that have been exposed to wild bacteria. Bacteria proliferate alongside the mycelium and produce their own toxin-digesting enzymes. This form of mycelium is far better equipped for handling toxic waste sites than mycelium not pre-exposed to wild microbes. For this reason, using pure culture spawn for mycoremediation may not be the best choice. Aged mycelium from a mushroom farm has better mycoremediation properties. One U.S. city that has been something of a laboratory for bioremediation activists is New Orleans. Common Ground, a grassroots group formed after the 2005 Hurricane Katrina flooding disaster in the city, has published The New Orleans Residents' Guide to Do-It-Yourself Soil Cleanup Using Natural Processes. In it, they note that every city in the United States is contaminated by chemicals that are potentially deadly. The greater New Orleans area also has a history of oil and chemical industries that generate and store thousands of tons of toxic chemicals. When hit by the floodwaters and hurricane winds of both Katrina and Rita, many of these chemicals floated out of their storage locations and into people's homes in adjacent neighborhoods. The sediment deposited by floodwaters contains unsafe levels of certain contaminants: arsenic, diesel fuel and other petrochemicals, heavy metals, phthalates, chemicals used to soften plastics, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, and pesticides. To clean up toxic soil, they recommend using multiple bioremediation strategies. For removing heavy metals, they suggest phytoremediation, with hyperaccumulator plants, including sunflowers, Indian mustard, peas, Asiatic dayflower, brake fern, lamb's quarters, radishes, corn, spinach, and carrots. For removing petrochemicals and pesticides, they suggest mycoremediation with oyster mushroom spawn. And for everyone, they recommend aerated compost tea, which the organization helps people make. The Common Ground activists also recommend using EM, not for soil remediation, but rather for removing mold from damaged interiors of flooded houses. When EM is sprayed in an untouched, moldy house and left for a day, the house becomes much safer and cleaner for crews to enter, states the DIY cleanup guide. My friend Free, who went to New Orleans after Katrina to volunteer in the restoration efforts, emailed me at the time. Mold was in the walls, the floors, the ceiling, everywhere. I couldn't help but feel like gutting was a futile act. How could this moldy environment ever be clean enough for the family to return to it? Working with Common Ground, she learned that EM presents a solution. As the DIY cleanup guide explains, this group of bacteria kills and prevents further mold growth. While bleach also kills mold, it has been shown to be less effective at keeping the mold from growing back over time. Waste management. Humans create waste at a vast scale. We use excessive packaging designed to resist biodegradation. We embrace up-to-the-minute gadgetry and dispose of the outdated models. We create dangerous radioactive waste that we do not have any idea what to do with. In our insatiable collective hunger to exploit and consume resources, accidents occur, spilling oil, releasing radiation, and leaving toxic contaminants. But our biological byproducts do not have to be considered as waste. Waste is not inevitable. In natural systems, there is no waste. Each creature's byproducts are fodder for some other creature. This is the reason the earth is not piled with feces and dead bodies. Feces and urine are examples of natural, beneficial, organic materials excreted by the bodies of animals after completing their digestive processes, observes Joseph Jenkins, author of the cult classic The Humanure Handbook. They are only waste when we discard them. When recycled, they are resources. Early human settlements did not have to worry much about disposing of their poop. In many places, traditions emerged in which human feces were recycled into nutrients for intensive agriculture. Elsewhere, dispersal was generally adequate, and as it washed into rivers along with all the other creatures' byproducts, human excrement nourished microbes and they cycled the nutrients, making them available to other life forms and maintaining the cleanliness of the water. The problems begin when large concentrations of excrement accumulate in waterways, triggering rapid microbial growth that exhausts the oxygen in the water. Like an overheating compost pile, an overnourished stream can go anaerobic. This in turn suffocates fish and other aquatic life. Soon, such a stream would be black, slimy, stinky, and dead to all but those creatures who could live without oxygen, writes Jeanette Farrell. Jenkins lays out simple methods for aerobic composting of humanure, along with sawdust and kitchen and garden scraps, not much different from the composting techniques described earlier, other than the inclusion of human feces as a feedstock. Jenkins addresses concerns about fecal pathogens, pointing out a hot compost pile can destroy pathogens in mere minutes. Lower temperatures require longer periods of time, possibly hours, days, weeks, or months, to effectively destroy pathogens. One need not strive for extremely hot temperatures, such as 65 degrees Celsius, 150 degrees Fahrenheit, in a compost pile to feel confident about the destruction of pathogens. It may be more realistic to maintain lower temperatures in a compost pile for longer periods of time, such as 50 degrees Celsius, 122 degrees Fahrenheit, for 24 hours, or 46 degrees Celsius, 115 degrees Fahrenheit, for a week. A sound approach to pathogen destruction when composting humanure is to thermophilically compost the toilet material, then allow the compost to sit, undisturbed, for a lengthy period of time after the thermophilic heating stage has ended. The biodiversity of the compost will aid in the destruction of pathogens as the compost ages. The techniques can be very simple and laid back, but any humanure composting takes a bit of active management. When people live in dense settlements, such as New York, the city of 8 million in which I grew up, our biological byproducts require very active management. The way most municipal systems are conceptualized, the excrement is treated as a waste product rather than a resource. The waste is multiplied by the use of precious water to flush it away. We further turn our excrement from a resource into a liability by mixing into the potty water all the chemicals people pour down drains, the pharmaceuticals we take, industrial waste, hospital waste, storm sewers carrying whatever leaks onto the streets from cars, chemical tanks, or who knows where. Our nutritious shit, embodying future fertility, becomes a cesspool of chemical waste. Sewage treatment is designed merely to do the work of a stream, but on a grand scale, explains Jeanette Farrell. After we flush, whether it goes through an elaborate civic infrastructure into a municipal wastewater treatment facility or a backyard septic tank system, it is bacteria that break down our feces and recycle the nutrients embedded in them. Septic tank systems rely upon swamp-like anaerobic digestion, less efficient than oxidative metabolism, with many byproducts. Methane, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide gases are produced, as well as a sludge of high molecular weight hydrocarbons, explains a Northern Arizona University website on the microbiology of sewage. This sludge will readily decompose further when exposed to oxygen and aerobic bacteria. Septic tanks periodically need to have sludge removed and sent to sewage treatment plants, or sometimes landfills. At any hardware store, you can buy septic treatment products that are bacteria and enzyme mixes intended to improve or speed digestion in the tank. My plumber friend Joe Prince says to flush a piece of bacteria-rich raw chicken skin down the toilet if your septic system is sluggish. In contrast with the septic tank, most large-scale sewage treatment relies upon aerobic organisms and their faster oxidative metabolism to digest massive accumulations of excrement in quite literally a river of water. Primary treatment filters large solids from wastewater and separates matter that sinks to the bottom or floats to the top. In secondary treatment, the water is usually heavily aerated to promote oxidative metabolism of nutrients in the water. Like a huge compost pile, this is a closely monitored and highly managed environment, in which it is crucial to maintain adequate levels of oxygenation. Sewage treatment plants are often described as bacteria farms, in which the flows of nutrients and oxygen must be regulated in order to maintain the health of the bacterial population. The big challenge in wastewater treatment is not removing nutrients, as fecal matter and other organics are collectively known, but rather removing all the toxic chemicals that are also present. These unseparated toxins are what prevents the sludge that is a byproduct of wastewater treatment from being safe to use in agricultural composts. Even at mass scale, if we could somehow collect our excrement separately from toxic chemicals, it would be easy to compost the sludge into biological fertilizers. Perhaps more intelligent designs will emerge over time. But for now, the toxic sludge remaining after sewage treatment mostly ends up in landfills. By burying sludge, we're burying a source of food, argues Joseph Jenkins. That's a cultural practice that should be challenged. While fermentation has been effectively applied to the problems of waste management, we would do better to work toward totally eliminating the concept of waste and the problems of waste management and reframe the objective as resource recovery.